sees sufficient strength in the economy in terms of spending, that growth with its ups and downs, but nevertheless is strong enough, looks to be strong enough in the medium term to support ongoing improvement in the labor market, and all of that is good. The median projection for the federal funds rate is 1.4% at the end of this year, 2.1% at the end of next year. The committee announced today that it will begin its balance sheet normalization program in October. This year, the shortfall of inflation from 2%, when none of those factors is operative, is more of a mystery. We want to be careful not to allow the economy to overheat in a way that would force us later on, somewhere down the road, to have to tighten monetary policy rapidly, which could cause a recession. As I said before, there's nothing set in stone about the policy paths. There's a great deal of uncertainty around them.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, another good week for the market, somewhat mixed, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average hitting new records and oil prices firmly over $50 a barrel. What a change from where we were a couple weeks ago. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in hour one, we will have an extended technical analysis coming from Ryan Poplava this week. We will also be talking with Dan Stevens at Energy Prospectus as we take a look at some of the fundamentals of oil. Why is oil prices over 50? Is it weather related, or is there much more? And we'll be talking a lot about oil on this week's program. All of that is coming up in hour one of this program.
And I'm John Loeffler. Well, the Fed met this week, and no surprise, they left interest rates unchanged. However, the press conference that they held clarified the Fed's future intentions. They intend to go forward raising interest rates and beginning another form of tightening in the balance sheet. But why are we doing this when you look at the fact that inflation is theoretically low? The economy, it's sort of anemic in economic growth right now. Why are they doing this? And of course, what does that mean for investments? You know, since bottoming in early June, the price of oil has risen from $42 a barrel to over $50 a barrel. Many people believe this is probably just due to weather-related events. We did dissent from that quite a bit and say really the fundamentals of energy are actually improving, and it just takes a certain amount of lag time before people recognize exactly what's going on. Those will be the subjects of conversation today on The Big Picture as part of the Financial Sense News Hour. And to plow into the program for this week, first on to the market update with Ryan Poplava, also filling in for our technician. So it seems like, Ryan, it was a good week overall with all-time highs hit for the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the S&P 500, and the NASDAQ composite at some point this week, all adding to the growth in the averages from last week. Now, in what is typically a weak period for stocks, that's August, September, and October, it's actually shaping up to be just the opposite. So why do you suppose the market is bucking what we usually see as seasonal trends that we typically see at this time?
Well, I think, you know, in different years, we've had different chart patterns or different market patterns where, you know, we're either trading sideways. Maybe there's a correction, an incident like the Chinese had in 2015 with currency issues there with the yuan valuations. We've had different situations. Right now, I think politically, geopolitically, it's obviously North Korea. From a climate perspective, it's also been the hurricanes. So we typically get into a situation where a hurricane can really slam into the East Coast and the Gulf production in oil and energy and refinery. It can also have a very adverse effect on housing constructions. And so we can have these seasonal issues typically around this time that can definitely affect those things. If you go back a couple of years, we've looked at how winter has had such a huge effect on retail with very severe winters and cold snaps that we had in, I think it was 2015 and 14. So anyways, seasonally, you know, things can happen that create these sort of technical seasonal trends that we see in the markets. But let's remember right now that the equity market, John, is in an uptrend. Okay. We haven't had any kind of serious corrections in the market. The dips that we've have been experiencing related to, like I said, North Korea, hurricanes, profit taking, you know, a portfolio repositioning. There was, you know, a lot of discussion about volatility being very, very low and being an attractive point to invest in volatility. And we saw that happen in August, and we saw some big spikes in volatility briefly, but none of those really created any kind of a de-risking repositioning move in the market. And that in itself, not experiencing any major corrections, can be enough for money to just continue to chase money, not wanting to be left behind in performance. You know, portfolio managers, they got to keep up with their performance. They can't lose out to the S&P 500, or clients move on and move elsewhere. So anyways, beyond that, you know, treasury yields were dropping in August. So that was kind of an indication of de-risking. And that was related to North Korean missile tests and bomb tests. And also in the addition to that, we had falling CPI data throughout the summer, but those have all reversed. I mean, North Korea obviously hasn't reversed. We got another announcement, I think, this week that they're planning to do an actual hydrogen bomb test in the Pacific Ocean, they announced. And North Korean problems, they're not going away. However, let's look at what happened this week. Trump spoke before the UN, taking a very hard stance on Korea testing weapons of mass destruction and criticism towards the Iran nuclear deal, which means that he may be looking towards reversing that deal or reorganizing it in a manner that he feels is a little bit stronger. He also signed an executive order this week aimed at individuals and businesses involved with North Korea. Tit for tat, like I said, North Korea announced a planned test for a hydrogen bomb. So things aren't going away. And North Korea is not going away. But, you know, despite those issues, U.S. stocks climbed higher this week. And like I said, I think last week we talked about it as well. And we're going to be talking about it a lot if North Korea keeps these tests and Trump keeps making it a point to focus on it. If investors don't see, John, an escalation between these two issues, Trump and his measures, and then also in North Korea and all of their tests. If we don't see an escalation, they're going to say, okay, another missile test this week. Okay, we've seen this before. Market's still going to move higher. It just doesn't appear that these sanctions and anything right now is really helping to de-escalate things. So we're at a kind of an equilibrium here between North Korea and the U.S. But like I said, if you remember, from our history, let's go back to World War II. If you remember what happened back then, the U.S. froze assets in Japan when Japan began some imperialistic moves, taking a couple airfields. And then the U.S. announced an oil embargo over Japan. We were exporting to them. And, you know, things obviously eventually led to a conflict. So there's still that chance for that. And I very much think that a North Korea conflict, anything remotely close to that, you're going to see a market correction. No question in my mind. But going back to just what's going on, what's bucking the trends, summarizing kind of what's going on in the U.S. markets right now, the biggest thing I can say that's really helping equity markets stay elevated is that some of the laggards over the past few months and also this whole year are actually rallying very strongly. We talked about energy last week bucking the relative strength trend, which means that its underperformance versus the S&P has been broken and is now in fact outperforming the S&P. And we're also seeing financials, and in fact, just recently, this last couple of weeks, we're starting to see the unloved area in retailers. You know, we've heard a lot about Amazon this year buying out wholesale and its effects on every time Amazon's announced something along those lines. We've seen these retailer stocks go down, Costco go down, etc. Now we're starting to see some improvement there. So the laggards are starting to improve, and that's increasing overall breadth, participation in the market in the rallies in general. And that's a good thing.
Let us turn to the Fed's decision this week. It wasn't any surprise that they didn't raise interest rates. It sounds like it was widely expected, especially after the CPI figures you mentioned last week were higher. You said chances of a third rate hike in December went from 30% to 50% after the CPI was released. So with the Fed introducing its policy to unwind its balance sheet, and another hike plan this year still based on their estimates. How did the markets react to that this week? It seems like hardly anyone took notice.
You're right, but leading up to this week, and like I said, the CPI figures, that was a big deal last week. Treasury yields have been on the rise. for about 2 weeks now. And really, we started to see it that very Monday, 2 weeks ago, when Irma was downgraded over the weekend. We started to see the yields on the 10-year bounced from, we were near, very near 2%. It was like 2.06, something like that. Finished this week right around 2.25, 2.26, somewhere around there. And then let's look at the 2-year. The 2-year treasury moved from 1.25, same time frame, up to around 1.44%. So both have moved up like 25 basis points up to 20 in the same period, while the yield curve, you know, that gap between the 2-year and the 10-year, that has steepened slightly. And that's typically a sign of economic expansion, a sign of growth. But having both rise roughly thereabouts the same, that's right now a sign of strength and a sign that investors are essentially taking on more risk, getting out of treasuries, a safe area, safe investment, and getting into, again, more stocks, more bonds. Commodities have done well recently. And overall, what's interesting to me from a technical point of view is that the rise in yields is also going to help, you know, what kind of stocks? It's going to help financials. But interestingly, it didn't help the dollar. Typically, rising interest rates, especially if our interest rates are rising and overseas, they're not, right? They're keeping them low. That differential between the two typically, as there's a chase for yield, leads investors to bring their money over here in the US dollars. That's not happening. You know, so right now, the dollar's been basically flat since yields started climbing in the last 2 weeks. And usually the dollar, like I said, tends to follow policy. But if we're seeing weakness in the dollar, if it's moving sideways with yields climbing, which means people are also selling U.S. treasuries, and then look at gold. Gold has been down for the past 2 weeks, down slightly below 1300. That's where that important breakout above 1300 happened with the missile test that we saw from North Korea last month in August. When we see those three moving down, you know, that's the risk off trade. That's the safety trade. And that's essentially been turned off over the last 2 weeks. Again, correlating to the why the market's moving up, you're seeing people move out of those defensive areas.
Yeah, and risk off is when investors bid up treasury prices, the dollar, gold, sometimes it's called the safety trade. All of those investments have been down over the last couple of weeks, as you mentioned. So it seems anyway, you can clearly see a rotation happening out of those areas. Now, if they're moving out of those areas, where is the money being positioned now? Before you answer, you mentioned last week you were looking strongly into energy, with a couple of catalysts being the International Energy Agency's prediction that global oil demand is set to accelerate at its fastest pace in 2 years. You also mentioned that energy had broken its relative strength downtrend and a sign that its underperformance versus the S&P 500 was over. So is energy the only place investors are rethinking right now and into which they're moving money, or are there other places where money is being repositioned?
Well, energy is definitely a sector that managers and investors are repositioning towards. It's been just a relentless rally over the past 2 weeks. And it got even more help this week, John, from comments by Jabar Ali al-Luwabi, Iraq's oil minister, who he basically said that a lot of the members he's been talking to are discussing possible extensions to the cuts, which are supposed to go to the end of this year, and I think some part of next year, and extending it throughout the full end of 2018. So another major extension to the cuts in time. And remember when we discussed that back, I think during the summer when they were reevaluating that, and they came out with that extension in time, the market was really unimpressed, and oil dropped considerably because what we wanted to see was an additional cut. Well, guess what? Now they're talking not only about the extension, but again, about a cut. We'll see what we'll see. But it's interesting because despite the build in crude inventories this week, that news by the oil minister helped oil hit fresh near-term highs, and it's now in the 50s. But yeah, as you asked, the other areas that are seeing increased love, as you might say, is the financials. Like I mentioned, with the yields climbing, that's a really great thing for financials. And last week, you know, I brought up the financials led by the insurers, because what happened, you know, they got crushed by Hurricane Harvey. The damage was fairly severe. When we got the downgrade rate in Irma from a 4 down to a 2 very quickly. You know, it hadn't made landfall for very long, got categorized, downgraded down to the category 2 once hitting Florida. Estimates for damages went down considerably, and those insurers bounced back with a vengeance on that Monday, leading the rest of the financials. And then, of course, like I said, with the yield curve rising as well, you know, the financials responded very, very nicely. In fact, I believe the sector itself is up near its highs for the year. So those are the real two key areas. And again, when you know, it's just confirming the stability in the financial system right now with higher rates. That kind of compounds the confidence in the sector and in the economy itself. When financials are leading, you know, you listen to Vermilion Research technicians Dave Nikoski, John Betts, and Shelley Moen, who have been on their show, who really specialize on sector rotation. They'll tell you if financials are performing, you know, that's a good sign for the economy and stocks in general.
Well, Ryan, you've done a lot to look at the U.S. markets here with some of the catalysts propelling those sectors or asset classes. Let's look across the oceans here. What can you tell us about what's going on overseas? I know PFS has been investing a sizable portion of your clients' funds there, so there must be something.
Yes. And, you know, going back to many of our discussions that we've had, John, you and I, we've talked about valuations, right? That leads us to, if there's anything that's fairly predictive, you know, of course there's charts, there's trend lines. We can follow momentum indicators, et cetera. But from a very long-term perspective, when we look at markets, you look at valuations. If something's very expensive, you know, what's the chances of great growth in that area? Not very much. We've looked at it historically through many studies. So with the U.S., with valuations getting stretched, as many would say, in specific areas, obviously the large cap area where, you know, there's been a lot of concentration and maybe overcrowding, some would say, in the tech sector. It's been performing all year long. You know, the Apples, the Amazons, the Googles, the Alphabet, the Fang, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, these areas that have been just performing very well, the valuations are high. We look overseas, right? And we don't see that. We don't see very stretched valuations, very expensive valuations. Why? Because their recovery was delayed relative to ours. You know, we were a lot more aggressive on monetary policy, and that led to just a more stable market recovery for us. And not so much overseas. You know, they started more aggressively on their QE by the ECB. I think 2015 they extended it up to $80 billion. In 2016 they were still doing it. So, you know, their recovery has been a little bit later. So valuations are cheap. That's why, you know, things are doing well now. You know, the recovery has been full blown now. Looking at what's going on in the equity markets overseas, what's performing the best? Developed markets. So that's the markets like Europe, Japan. And these we would call developed markets. Emerging markets are, you know, China, even though it's been growing at a extremely healthy clip, you know, right around 6 to 7% over the last few years, up to 14% 10 years ago, et cetera, et cetera. The areas that performed really great 10 years ago are the same ones that are outperforming right now. It's your BRIC areas. I call it back to BRIC. Brazil, Russia, India, and China, 8 shares. They're doing very well, and they're outperforming what we call the emerging market sector. So that's doing very well. And the areas that are performing very well within that, we're seeing is both technology as well as manufacturing and construction. On the technology side, what do we see over the last 2 weeks? Semiconductors were going up with the markets. And then there was NVIDIA, which has been kind of leading the charge in semiconductors, got an upgrade on Friday. I forget by who. And then Bank of America on Monday, increasing their target. That really helped the whole semiconductor area in the industry. And where do we see a lot of that? We see a lot of those companies overseas. You know, the other area, like I said, is manufacturing and construction. I'd say it has been a theme that has been working with the whole idea of recovery in emerging markets. And if you take a look at a couple of the multinationals here in the U.S. that deal with that area, specifically, you know, the real big proxy used for looking at global growth is Caterpillar. And Caterpillar just hit all-time highs this week. Essentially, to me, John, just a sign of the times. A sign that we're seeing both semiconductors, tech is leading overseas, as well as manufacturing and construction.
Okay, anything else, Ryan, you want to leave off with our listeners for the week in review? Any economic data?
Two data points, John, I guess, that are really important this week. It's the jobless claims. They dropped down to 259,000, essentially indicating that companies are very loath to let go of employees while the labor market continues to tighten. Yet we're still not seeing the broad jump yet in wage inflation, which the Fed watches. If we do see that in any regard, we're going to continue to really want to watch that data point. If we're seeing some wage inflation, you're going to see the Fed start to tighten more aggressively, and that would be the sign that we're finally at that final phase of the bull market. As it stands now, the dot plot, that's what the Fed members use to estimate each one, saying their consensus of where they think rates are going to be. They're all pointing towards another three hikes next year. But finally, I guess if there was one more data point I'd look at, it would be the housing data. This week showed a drop in starts and existing sales. That number isn't significant alone, but what we do see that has been developing over this year is a consensus that housing starts aren't enough right now to help with the supply pressures we're seeing. There's very low inventories. That is essentially raising housing prices. Housing prices rising, that's great. That's great for the consumer's balance sheet. But we get to a point where if they continue to rise, that lowers the affordability. If we lower the affordability, then you're going to lower sales. So it's not enough to be in dire concern yet. Like I said, if housing construction doesn't help increase inventory or more existing houses come for sale, it could continue to keep prices high and, again, sales low. Economics 101, John. Anecdotally, I've been hearing there's quite a few people I know with rentals here in California, up the coast, even in mid-California, Northern California. We're hearing that there's actually an oversupply of rentals in California. And from what I understand in real estate, that tends to be a pendulum from between rentals and sales. And right now, having that oversupply of rentals, that's driving rental rates down. So tale of two rentals, tale of two real estates, I guess you'd call it.
So it would seem, Ryan Poplava, appreciate it. Look forward to seeing you back again next week.
You got it, John. We'll talk to you next week.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
Here's a reminder that if you're not listening to the daily Financial Sense News Hour, you're really missing a lot. Let me show you.
What we really have is just a growth trade, I mean, particularly globally. And that's what's supporting stocks and supporting a weaker dollar. You know, global growth being stronger is a good reason to expect dollar weakness. If you look at most of the weakness in the dollar, it's coming against countries that have seen sharp upward revisions to their own GDP numbers. And so, you know, if you're asking me what do I think about going forward through year end, I mean, I think you'll have a growth trade, but a U.S. growth trade. So that maybe pushes some consolidation in the dollar, pushes bond yields up a little bit, you know, kind of keeps the stock market recovery going, maybe not at the same pace that we've seen so far this year. So that's what I expect. You know, I think it's an environment where you should be tilting your portfolio to cyclical type sectors. But I think what we have is a growth trade, one that's supported by earnings. And I think that if you look at inflation expectations, they'll probably keep moving up slowly, but back up towards where they were earlier in the year.
Well, the price of oil is finally back up over $50. Recently, the IEA reported that global demand is increasing for this year and expected to do so for next year. Inventories are tightening and continuing to fall, and rig counts have recently begun to decrease. Joining us on the program from Energy Prospectus Group is Dan Steffens. Dan, let's talk about the energy markets here. And the first thing that I want to begin with, and this is something that I learned from the late Matt Simmons, was that a lot of these reports that we get, whether they're inventory levels reported by the EIA or they are production levels reported, a lot of these are just estimates and models. It's not precise measurements, like somebody's out there with a dipstick each week and is sticking it in the tank and you're getting a precise measurement. Let's begin with that, because a lot of the numbers, whether we're looking at energy or we're looking at the economic numbers with all these seasonal adjustments that get redone, let's talk about how this applies to the energy markets and how these perceptions may be wrong in terms of what is actually happening.
Well, for one thing, I think people need to remember that this is a business, an industry with very big numbers. And so that when, you know, EIA reports that crude oil inventories are up 4 million barrels or down 4 million barrels or whatever, well, that's in relationship to a total inventory of 450 or 460 million barrels. So on a percentage basis, I mean, 4 million sounds like a lot, but on a percentage basis, it's not that much. And then you have two agencies. You have API reports, inventory weekly statistical numbers every Tuesday after the market closes. Then EIA reports the official numbers on Wednesday morning. And they're often drastically different. And people say, well, wait a minute, they're looking at the same thing. So how do they come up with these drastically different numbers? Well, they have different formulas. And EIA numbers, especially for production, especially for U.S. production, they do not have gauges on every well in the United States, so they have really no way to know. So it's all based on trends, trend analysis by region, how many rigs, how many completions and stuff they've got going in those regions, but it's very much guesswork, and it's, you know, trying to predict a very big number so you can be off pretty far. And you don't really know actual U.S. production until about 3 months after. Like right today, the most current actual numbers we have for production are June, and if you go back and look at the weekly reports, EIA overreported June production by more than 220,000 barrels a day. If they would have reported those numbers accurately, you probably would have higher oil prices already today. But I think the market is starting to figure that out, that supply and demand are actually much tighter than people realize.
And so whether we're looking at production or looking at, let's say, inventory numbers, this applies across the board. The one thing that has surprised me as I take a look at this is when you look at the profits in the S&P 500, everybody's been ecstatic. The markets are up, setting new records. Most people don't realize, Dan, that a good portion of those profits in the first and second quarter came from the energy sector, which you think would be a good thing until you look at the energy stocks, which have been decimated.
I know. I follow about 50 publicly traded companies, and almost all of them, their share prices are down year to date, even though they're having a much better year this year in the first half of the year than they did last year in the first half of the year. You know, oil ran up to $50, $55 in the first quarter, and they all had good earnings. And it's just this fear that there's going to be this big collapse in oil and gas prices. And I don't see it happen. I don't see any way sub-$50 oil, that price could be maintained and meet future demand for refined products. I just don't see any way. There's not enough areas outside of the absolute sweet spots of these shale plays where you could make a dime, really, at below $50. So you've got to have pretty decent prices.
Let's talk about how this market works. I mean, we saw a nice run-up of energy stocks last year after OPEC made the announcement of production cuts, even though they didn't take place to the beginning of the year. And there were a lot of big bets that were made by the hedge fund community, everybody expecting higher oil prices. And then all of a sudden, as everybody was looking at inventory levels, markets began to collapse again as we got to the end of the first quarter. And even recently, you probably know his name, the oil god.
Yeah, Andy Hall.
And he closed down his hedge fund after 30% losses. So if this information is so incomplete, it's amazing the world's biggest business is oil, how we don't have really good information and how much what we're going by, Dan, is based on these production models, which are just estimates of existing trends. I mean, that could get you in a very tough situation. It seems to me like the oil market can be boom and bust. And all of a sudden, like you said, you look at the June actual numbers, the EIA overestimated production by 200,000 barrels. You know, what happens down the line when we find out the inventories aren't as big as they are, nor were production levels as big as they were, given where world demand is?
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty frightening. And, you know, I've been in this business for almost 40 years, and I've seen many cycles. And you go back, and typically cycles last about 2 years. And this one's going on over 3 years. And it's kind of the longer they last, the bigger the reversal. And I think you can go from a supply glut to a supply shortage very quickly. And there's one thing that's really unique about crude oil is that a little bit of a surplus, even a 1% or 1.5% surplus, creates a big drop in the price, but a 1% or 1.5% shortage of supply creates an outsized spike in the price because it's a commodity that is so important to people's standard of living, and so important to all businesses that we have this steady, consistent flow of energy. And when it's cut off, man, people will pay whatever to get it, and you get these big price spikes. And I don't think we're going to see 100 anytime soon, but I certainly can see $65 oil in 3 or 4 months. Actually, Raymond James is predicting $65 oil by the end of the year because they see big draws from crude oil storage coming in the fourth quarter. Because for one thing, you know, we've really depleted gasoline and diesel inventories because these refineries have gone down. And so the refineries are going to have to stay at real high capacity rates all the way through the end of the year to rebuild those fuel inventories that are so desperate. I mean, did you see, I mean, shortly after Hurricane Harvey hit Houston, did you see how quickly we had gasoline shortages all over the country?
Oh, yeah. We have clients in Florida who had to evacuate ahead of that big hurricane. And they said, they said it was very difficult because you weren't sure if you got on the road, if you were going to be able to get gasoline.
Yeah. The gasoline delivery system to the stations near your home are very much just-in-time inventories. If you have a significantly busy gas station on a busy corner, they're getting a new supply every day or two. You know, in the middle of the night, they'll have these tanker trucks come and filling up their tanks again. And if they're cut off from that, the next morning, they're out of gas. That's it. You know, they scare everybody and go fill up your tanks before these hurricanes hit. And before Hurricane Harvey made landfall down there by Corpus Christi, well, I was past 3 or 4 gas stations before I found one that had any gasoline.
You know, this is something that has been demonstrated over and over again when it comes to oil markets. And, you know, here's a good example. We had a hurricane that hit Houston, and look what happened to gasoline stocks as those refineries were taken offline. We saw it happen before in 2005 with Katrina and Rita, where a lot of offshore rigs were taken offline. And we saw it, what was it, just 2 years ago, Dan, with the Canadian oil sands fire that took 1 million barrels offline. So people, you know, we can talk about surpluses all we want, but it doesn't take but one kind of weather-related event or some event like a fire in the Canadian oil sands, and all of a sudden, people wake up and say, uh-oh, 1 million barrels just disappeared, and look what happens to the price of oil. You get these spikes as we're seeing now.
Yeah, there was a big article in the Houston paper after Hurricane Harvey that said these refineries were taken down by flooding. I mean, we had areas that had 50 inches of rain in like 3 days. It was unbelievable. But if we would have had a Category 5 hurricane hit directly, come across Galveston there, and, you know, stay over the area for any length of time that would do significant damage to these big refineries, you could have shortages for a long time. You could have gasoline lines rationing across the eastern half of the country for months. And there was an article that we got to do a better job of building strategic reserves of refined products. We have strategic reserve of crude oil, but we need strategic reserves of fuel we can use. You know, you and I don't burn crude oil in our cars, so we could have, you know, 1 billion barrels of crude oil sitting in some underground storage facility down here that government controls, but that doesn't do us any good if we don't have refineries to turn it into products we can use. So there needs to be some real hard look at this, because really Houston is too important to have this exposed to the hurricanes. And you couldn't have asked for a path. Go, you know, making landfall at Corpus Christi and going all the way across southern Louisiana and causing that much flooding and that much damage is pretty unbelievable, really.
Once again, it emphasizes how fragile the energy infrastructure is, whether it's offshore platforms in an area that is hit by hurricanes, or as you just mentioned, those refineries all along the coast in Texas that just got hit with a major hurricane. I want to talk about the energy stocks themselves. It seems like the market is finally waking up to this. On the day you and I are speaking, we've got West Texas crude over 50. And if you look at within the S&P sector funds, the ETFs. Finally, the XLE is finally gotten a liftoff here at the beginning of September. So it seems like the market is finally taking cognizance of this. But is there anything that could throw this off? Because you know what happens? You get one inventory report, and I'm trying to think of which month it was. The inventory level spiked 1 week. Instead of a drawdown, it was an increase, which once again, these are just estimates based on models, and the markets all freak out and oil prices tumbled. So could we see anything like that going into the latter part of the year?
Well, you always could if you had several weeks in a row where you had very bearish supply-demand numbers. I think what we're going to see out of IEA, and the IEA, which is the International Energy Agency out of Paris, they're more of a global watchdog than EIA is just looking at. That's our Department of Energy group. They're just looking at the U.S. market, more or less. And so when IEA puts out their monthly oil market report, it draws more attention. And that's what pushed oil above $50, their report of increased demand. And I expect those reports to get more bullish as we move through the year. As long as OPEC stays 80, 85% compliant with their agreement, this thing's going to get back in balance here pretty quick, and it already is. And I think we're going to see some pretty big draws from crude oil inventory, OECD inventories in the last quarter of the year. The hurricanes have kind of messed things up a little bit with supply and demand for the different products. So that's kind of a bit confusing to the market. So we need to get past hurricane season, thank goodness, and get everything settled down, and I think we'll be okay. But yeah, I mean, you could have something, if North Korea nukes us or something, I guess that would definitely throw a wrench into the mix here.
So as you look at the energy industry, once again, if you take a look at profits in the first and second quarter, a good majority of the increase in the S&P came from a lot of these energy companies, large, small, or medium. It didn't matter where you looked in the energy sector. It was rebounding because of the resiliency of the sector where they can make profits at lower levels to produce this oil. What about the sector now? I mean, you know, you look at some of the big guys, you're getting dividends of anywhere from 4 to over 6%. Even on some of the mid-tiered companies, they're looking very healthy. Do you think the investment community is waking up to this? Or once again, is this another false start as we've seen so many times? It's hard to believe we had that nice run-up going into last year. And then you go back to the beginning of the year, and it's just like the energy sector stocks have been going down since the beginning of the year.
Well, the first thing that's got to happen is the Wall Street firms have to increase the prices in the commodity price decks that they use to value these companies. And I know some of them are using very conservative numbers. I did see a report from Stifel yesterday that four of my favorite stocks they had picked with and put price targets on them way above my valuation, by the way. But I have a group that I call Sweet 16, and within the Sweet 16, there's eight companies that are S&P 500 companies. And they're all trading at big discounts to my valuations. And I'm still using, I'm assuming $50 oil and $3 natural gas forever in all my future periods. And I'm still coming up with valuations way above where these things are trading. They're trading as if oil's below 40 and gas is going to stay below $2 or something forever. But I think there's a lot more upside than there is downside at this point.
Well, one of the things that we've always seen in the markets, and just like the energy sector itself, if it's worth doing, it's worth overdoing, whether it's on the extreme upside, as we're seeing in some of these FANG stocks, or on the downside. It just seems to be characteristic of the market. So given where we are now, and given where these valuations, do you think it's safe to dip your toes in the energy sector for investors?
Yeah, and if you're looking for safety, I mean, just go with some of the larger cap companies. I mean, you look at like EOG Resources, a $50 billion market cap company. Devon Energy looks really good to me. Cimarex Energy, first-class outfit with a really strong balance sheet. I mean, look hard at their balance sheet. You know, what gets upstream companies in trouble is debt. And if they've got too much debt and not enough production to really support that debt, then that's what gets them in trouble. One way to look at it on the energy companies at this point is if they survived the last 3 years, they're pretty good. I mean, because they survived much worse prices than what we have today. So they're in much better shape on that side. And then do they have growth potential? Do they have a bunch of acreage where they've got, you know, hundreds or maybe thousands of low risk drilling inventories? And a lot of these companies that we follow do. And then if you like dividends, there are some really good dividend paying companies. And especially in the midstream area, we look at several midstream like pipelines, storage companies, the guys that take it from the oil field through the field level separation and then get it to the refiners. Those companies pay some really nice dividends. Now, a lot of them are structured as MLPs, but there's ways to buy them through their C-Corp general partners and stuff where you can get really nice dividends. And they have a lot of growth. And I think they're all trading about a 20 or 25% discount.
Dan, I want to talk about a final issue, which I see having an impact longer term on the energy sector as I've been following it. After 2014, you saw major companies from Exxon to Total to Royal Dutch, all the way down the spectrum of companies in terms of market size, they all began to slash their CapEx budgets. And you know, as well as I, any oil company that's producing oil, pushing it out the door today, has got to go somewhere and find oil to replace that which they're producing. And these oil budgets, I read a report last week where a lot of these, the CapEx spending is down as much as 50 and 60%. That has to have repercussions longer term for a number of reasons. One, we're seeing increased demand as the IEA has been reporting, some of the strongest demand we've seen in 2 years. Number two, you have depletion that is taking place. And then when you look at that together, and outside of shale, a lot of these projects, whether they're offshore or the bigger projects that you see, the majors are involved, these things take a long time to materialize. It's not like you get the budget, you poke a hole in the ground, and you know, a year later, you're producing oil.
Yeah, and one thing to remember with the larger companies, they're in a lot of these long-term projects where they were committed, especially like deep water. You've drilled the wells, you've ordered the platform, it's in design. You can't pull the plug on that project without a significant loss. So you have to keep going, hoping that commodity prices will bounce back before you get the thing online. And so they're committed to those. So they've got that much capital committed, and then a lot of their other offshore properties or big projects like the Canadian oil sands, they're not economic at this price. And so they pull back to where they're just doing just absolutely necessary capital spending to survive. And, you know, when they get in the survival mode, that's not good, but it's because they're committed to these long-range projects. And I think the thing that's attractive about the really top players in these shale plays, the ones that own a lot of this really good tier one acreage, where, I mean, the well-level economics at $30 oil is profitable in some of the really good areas. So you go up in this scoop and stack play up in Oklahoma where Continental and Devon and Cimarex are, man, the well-level economics, they're fabulous. But there isn't that much of it. And the majors are not in those plays. They came late to the party, and you don't see any of the majors. Marathon's up there, but they're not really a super major or anything. But they're up in Oklahoma in that stack play. But a lot of them missed this. So the better acreage is held by companies that a lot of people don't know as household names.
Dan, when you take a look at this energy sector, taking a look at it longer term, you and I were talking before we went on the air, you know, because analysts and fund managers get nervous anytime about the energy industry. It's almost like it's in dire straits. The world needs U.S. energy because the U.S. and oil production is one of the few places in the globe where we're seeing increased production come to meet this global demand that's growing by over 1 million barrels a day. How important the U.S. energy sector is to world global oil demand.
Yeah, there's absolutely no way to meet future demand for gasoline and diesel and feedstock without the U.S. energy business. Plus, we are leaders in technology also. I mean, this whole technology with horizontal drilling and the multi-stage fracking and the significant increases in the quality of seismic have all come from the U.S.-based service companies and working with our upstream companies. So without that, you're just never going to get it. So eventually, we need to have a really good price for these commodities so that the capital will flow into this sector. And we're not far off, really. If we just get back to like $55, $60 range and it goes in there, I think they'll be fine. And that wouldn't be too painful at the pump. I don't really think we need to get back to 100 or anything like that.
So, Dan, in summing up, several Wall Street firms have upped their projections for oil. You think we could hit 65, and some are saying 60 by year end. So where we are today, number one, you expect higher oil prices by the end of the year. And given where valuations are on energy companies, you expect them to outperform as we go forward, given their undervaluation.
Yeah, I just think if they just rebound to where they were at the first of the year, because they're going to end up with pretty good annual results. And I'm expecting a strong fourth quarter. In prior cycles, the fourth quarter has been a really strong quarter as these things, you know, really bounce back when people realize, hey, they're not going out of business. The first thing you have to convince Wall Street is they're not going out of business. Get that fear off the table. They're going to survive. And then what do they need to move forward. So I think if in the mind of Wall Street, we set that $50 is now the floor for price, okay, now we can start valuing these things based on the thought process that that's as low as it's going to get, and then I think we'll be okay.
Well, listen, Dan, as we close, if our listeners like to follow your work, tell them how they could do so, please.
Yeah, thanks a lot. You can check me out on energyperspectives.com, and we are a subscription service. We have about 500 members all across the United States and Europe, Japan, Cayman Islands, we have members, and they're really subscribing to get our reports on individual companies. We file very closely, about 50 companies, but we file about 200 reports, like including the quarterly updates on some of our model portfolio companies. But we got some large caps we follow, mid caps, you know, and some really small companies that we think have a lot of upside. So just depending on your risk profile, you can look. But if you just send me an email, you can send me an email at dmsteffens, S-T-E-F-F-E-N-S, at comcast.net, and I'll tell you how to join, or just go to our website.
The Fed met this week, and they left interest rates unchanged, which was not really a surprise, but their press conference afterward indicated that the Fed has future intentions, which plans to go forward with raising interest rates and another term of balance sheet tightening. So what is all of this going to mean for both the financial markets and for the economy, and why are they doing this at a time when inflation is admittedly low, and also the economy just staggering along at about 1%. So we'll look at all of that coming up next on The Big Picture as part of the Financial Sense News Hour. Also, since bottoming in early June, the price of oil has risen from $42 to over $50 a barrel, but everybody's saying, well, that's due to hurricanes. Is it? Or are the fundamentals for energy getting better? All of that coming up next on the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.